course of those intermediate steps, a displacement, let us say of the psychic accent, has taken place, until ideas that are at first weakly charged with intensity, by taking over the charge from ideas which have a stronger initial intensity, reach a degree of strength which enables them to force their way into consciousness. Such displacements do not at all surprise us when it is a question of the bestowal of effects, or of the motor actions in general. The fact that the woman who has remained single transfers her affection to animals, that the bachelor becomes a passionate collector, that the soldier defends a scrap of coloured cloth, his flag, with his life blood, that in a love affair a momentary clasping of hands brings bliss, or that in Othello a lost handkerchief causes a burst of rage, all these are examples of psychic displacement which seem unquestionable to us. But if, in the same manner and according to the same fundamental principles, a decision is made as to what is to reach our consciousness and what is to be withheld from it, that is to say, what we are to think, this produces an impression of morbidity, and we call it an error of thought if it occurs in waking life. We may here anticipate the result of a discussion which will be undertaken later, namely to the effect that the psychic process which we have recognized as dream displacement proves to be not a process morbidly disturbed, but a process differing from the normal merely in being of a more primitive nature. We thus find in the fact that the dream content takes up remnants of trivial experiences a manifestation of dream disfigurement by means of displacement, and we may recall that we have recognized this dream disfigurement as the work of a sensor which controls the passage between two psychic instances. We accordingly expect that dream analysis will regularly reveal to us the genuine, significant source of the dream in the life of the day, the recollection of which has transferred its accent to some indifferent recollection. This conception brings us into complete opposition to Robert's theory, which thus becomes valueless for us. The fact which Robert was trying to explain simply doesn't exist. Its assumption is based upon a misunderstanding, upon the failure to substitute the real meaning of the dream for its apparent content. Further objection may be made to Robert's doctrine. If it were really the duty of the dream, by means of a special psychic activity, to rid our memory of the slag of the recollections of the day, our sleep would have to be more troubled and employed in a more strained effort than we may suppose it to be from our waking life. For the number of indifferent impressions received during the day, against which we should have to protect our memory, is obviously infinitely large. The night would not be long enough to accomplish the task. It is very much more probable that the forgetting of indifferent impressions takes place without any active interference on the part of our psychic powers. Still something cautions us against taking leave of Robert's idea without further consideration. We have left unexplained the fact that one of the indifferent day impressions, one from the previous day indeed, regularly furnished a contribution to the dream content. Relations between this impression and the real source of the dream do not always exist from the beginning. As we have seen, they are established only subsequently, in the course of the dream work, as though in order to serve the purpose of the intended displacement. There must therefore be some necessity to form connections in this particular direction of the recent, although indifferent, impression. The latter must have special fitness for this purpose because of some property. Otherwise it would be just as easy for the dream thoughts to transfer their accent to some inessential member of their own series of associations. The following experiences will lead us to an explanation. If a day has brought two or more experiences which are fitted to stimulate a dream, then the dream fuses the mention of both into a single whole. It obeys an impulse to fashion a whole out of them. For instance, one summer afternoon I entered a railroad compartment in which I met two friends who were unknown to each other. One of them was an influential colleague, the other a member of a distinguished family whose physician I was. I made the two gentlemen acquainted with each other. But during the long ride, I was the go-between in the conversation, so that I had to treat a subject of conversation now with the one, now with the other. I asked my colleague to recommend a common friend who had just begun his medical practice. He answered that he was convinced of the young man's thoroughness, but that his plain appearance would make his entrance into households of rank difficult. I answered, "That is just why he needs recommendation." Soon afterwards I asked the other fellow traveller about the health of his aunt, the mother of one of my patients, who was at the time prostrated by a serious illness. During the night after this journey I dreamt that the young friend for whom I had asked assistance was in a splendid salon and was making a funeral oration to a select company with the air of a man of the world, the oration being upon the old lady, now dead for the purposes of the dream, who was the aunt of the second fellow traveller. I confess, frankly, that I had not been on good terms with this lady. My dream had thus found connections between the two impressions of the day, and by means of them composed a unified situation. In view of many similar experiences, I am driven to conclude that a kind of compulsion exists for the dream function, forcing it to bring together in the dream all the available sources of dream stimulation into a unified whole. In a subsequent chapter on the dream function, we shall become acquainted with this impulse for putting together as a part of condensation another primary psychic process. I shall now discuss the question whether the source from which the dream originates and to which our analysis leads must always be a recent and significant event, or whether a subjective experience, that is to say, the recollection of a psychologically valuable experience, a chain of thought, can take the part of a dream stimulus. The answer, which results most unequivocally from numerous analyses, is to the following effect. The stimulus for the dream may be a subjective occurrence, which has been made recent, as it were, by the mental activity during the day. It will probably not be out of place here to give a synopsis of various conditions which may be recognized as sources of dreams. The source of a dream may be A. A recent and psychologically significant experience which is directly represented in the dream. B. Several recent significant experiences which are united by the dream into a whole. C. One or more recent and significant experiences which are represented in the dream by the mention of a contemporary but indifferent experience. D. A subjective significant experience, a recollection, train of thought, which is regularly represented in the dream by the mention of a recent but indifferent impression. As may be seen in dream interpretation, the condition is firmly adhered to throughout that each component of the dream represents a recent impression of the day. The element which is destined to representation in the dream may either belong to the presentations surrounding the actual dream stimulus itself, and furthermore either as an essential or an inessential element of the same, or it may originate in the neighbourhood of an indifferent impression, which